Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. It's the first show of October, and as the days are getting shorter and noticeably cooler up here in the Northern Hemisphere, it seems like a good time to take stock of a few things that might keep us entertained on those cold, dark evenings. Autumn is the season of starting anew. The kids start new term at school, trees shed their leaves to get ready for the next year, and TVs buzz with delight as HBO releases its most exciting blockbuster series. And elsewhere in the realm of arts and culture, there's plenty of new stuff still to look forward to this year. On today's show, then, we're looking ahead to the tail end of 2016 in music, film and books for a hand-picked hit list of delights by our esteemed experts. And who might they be? They're only Will Hodgkinson, chief rock and pop critic for The Times, film critic Karen Krizanovich and founder of Unbound Publishers John Mitchinson. From David Bowie musicals to a study of menus and a trip to the cinema in between, let us be your autumn-winter guide to the rest of the year. That's all coming up on Culture right here on Monocle 24. Karen, Will, John, welcome to the programme. It's nice to have you around the table. This is, I think, the dream team we've got here. And as our green room banter will assert, everyone has brought their A games to today's programme. So we're going to start with music, Will.
Yes.
I could hardly get my words out in the introduction. I almost called you the croc critic of the Times.
Well, I sounded a little bit too prescient for me.
I can promise listeners he hasn't hobbled in here.
Give it a couple of years.
Yeah, okay. Where are we going? Talking of rebirth, Lazarus.
Well, it's been Bowie's year.
Yeah.
In the sense that the year began with his death and a huge reevaluation, as you'd expect. And, you know, it began with... He released an album which essentially turned his own death into an art form, which no one had done before. Absolutely brilliant swan song to an incredible career. And now comes Lazarus, so it's very, very suitably named. It's an unusual thing. I haven't actually seen it, but I've seen parts, and I've, you know, sort of heard bits and pieces. It seems like it started off as a sequel to The Man Who Fell to Earth, but it's also something I don't think Bowie acolytes would like to call it a jukebox musical, but it's got a touch of that.
Yeah, so the second half, it's got some greatest hits in there.
Yeah, it's got a lot of the most fantastic songs. But the first half, it's got new songs. It's got Lazarus, which is from the last album. Mm-hmm. And it's got Michael C. Hall playing the character. And it's Enda Walsh, who's the Irish playwright, who's done all kinds of good things. And Bowie was working on it right up until his death. So it's an unusual thing. And I think what's worth bearing in mind is that Bowie had an extremely, before he got famous, really, throughout the 60s, he was essentially a musical theatre pop star.
Yeah.
You know, he was
a bit of the Anthony Newleys about him. Right?
More than a little bit, exactly. Yeah. And then he was trained by Lindsay Kemp, and yeah. So, you know, the in mime. And so he had this very, very theatrical background, and that was certainly where he saw himself initially. And so I get the impression from all the bits I've gleaned about Lazarus that it touches on all kinds of aspects from his career. You know, you've got the very early period. Of course, you've got Man Who Fell to Earth, which is the sort of station-to-station mid-70s period, yeah. And going right up until the present day with the last album.
Well, let's get a clip. This is Michael C. Hall performing Lazarus, and then we'll talk a little bit about the idea of it being a musical rather than a film, because that Nick Rogue film was obviously such a classic. It's been sort of re-looked at again and again and again, and it gets more and more classic, if possible, every time it's watched and ascertained. Anyway, here's a little bit of Lazarus.
Look up here, I'm in heaven. I've got scars that can't be seen. I've got drama, can't be stolen. Everybody knows me now.
Okay, that is Lazarus, and it's beginning here in London on October the 24th. It's on all winter, I guess. Well, it's on until January, at least, until Christmas. Let's hear about someone new from Australia, Will, that you've picked out for us. This is Julia Jacklin. Why don't we have a little sample of a track called Same Airport, Different Man.
Same airport, different dress. This one is blue, and it is longer than the rest. Same effort, different dress. Last one was short and red and too tight for my growing chest.
Okay, Julia Jacklin, new talent from Australia, as picked by Will Hodgkinson. Will, talk us through Julia.
Julia Jacklin is a 24-year-old from the Blue Mountains in Australia. And
very Tolkien-ish.
Exactly. Well, it is, except for the fact that up until recently, maybe still, when, you know, I don't think her career's taken off that much, she was working on the factory production line of an essential oils factory, you know, okay. bottling it up. And yeah. I just thought that seemed, the music is very sort of dreamy and daydream-like. And
emollient.
I thought, exactly. Yeah. And I thought, well, yeah, if you're on a production line for 8 hours a day, especially, you know, inhaling all these essential oils, this is the music that would come out.
Okay, yeah.
And so I rather liked it. It's not, it's not kind of breaking any new ground. It sounds quite a lot like Fiona Apple and Cat Power and, you know.
There's a bit of Mazzy Star in there, isn't it?
Mazzy
Star. Very echoey. And,
folky indie, really.
Yeah.
But I just felt that all the songs had a kind of honesty. They're all just about growing up, really. You know, same airport, different man is, you know, self-explanatory, really. But all the songs, you know, there's one song where she talks about feeling guilty that her grandmother is dying and she's gone off on her gap year traveling around Thailand. And so it's all these kind of fairly immature thoughts, I guess, you know, or like early 20-something thoughts. And then she's just made songs out of them, which is what people do. And it just felt very natural. So that's what I liked about it.
I've been listening to this record. I've been enjoying it as well. It's got a great album cover, really unusual, strange album cover, kind of shot in some sort of modernist house. Well, it's sort of like a suburban modernist house, but she's kind of like on one of those exercise balls. It's kind of quite I want to see the LP of it because I think it's probably quite a striking image. It feels like it should be a classic album with such a strange album cover.
Well, I thought it was a pregnancy ball, but I was thinking, you know, I know my wife had one when she was pregnant, but I don't know if they're exercise balls as well. But anyway, it's nice.
And then this is a regular new segment with this program, which should be rather than judging a book by its cover, judging an album by its cover, right?
Well,
that's,
I always
this
do
is
that.
What we need. I always do that too. That's healthy.
It's my starting point.
Okay.
Well, I'm a personal trainer, so if you show me the cover, I can tell you what it is.
Have we got it?
I've got it here.
Okay, we'll fish it out before the end
of
the show.
That's the next segment.
For the next 20 minutes, we shall fish it out. The Lemon Twigs are your next choice. Again, I've been on the sort of PR gravy train for this one, and I almost didn't click on it because the men's haircuts are so bad.
Well, you know, one
Tell
man's terrible haircut is another man's, you know,
Valhalla,
Bowie-esque, you know, perfect construction. I just love these guys. I mean, they're 17 and 19 year old brothers. Very extreme haircuts. I mean, the 17-year-old.
We're talking mullets, by the way.
It's a mullet, but it's also a dyed mullet. So it's fringed to the bottom. Dyed blonde. He wears a lot of lipstick, and he's wearing, you know, women's shirts and a sort of flouncy scarf and everything. Very extreme fashion sense. And they're from upstate New York, from a small town. Dad was a musician, and the music. First of all, they're really good musicians. They can play everything. But the music is so, I find it fascinating that this two teenagers have got so deep into what's essentially kind of 70s power pop.
Yeah.
I mean, the thing that really reminds me of is Big Star, who's a fantastic band, but not known by everyone. There's also touches of solo Paul McCartney in there. You know, all
nothing
these things,
wrong with that.
Nothing wrong with that, but not things that you imagine the average kid in upstate New York to listen to. And I just think,
is this kind of sort of post Spotify music? Is this kind of like able to sort of pluck the gems from without having to buy them?
It's either that, or they've got a dad who just said everything finished in 1975. This is what
listen
you're listening
to. Okay. Listen to Ram. Listen to Ram.
Yes, exactly.
So
sounds great.
I just think it's great. I love it, and they were so funny. I went to see them live, and Brian, who's the younger one, was just doing these crazy high kicks throughout, and they swap instruments, and it was just really good fun. That was the thing. It's great fun.
Let's have a little bit of it then. This is the Lemon Twigs with a track called These Words. Okay, that is the Lemon Twigs from upstate New York. These words from the album called Do Hollywood. That's out next week on October the 14th on 4AD Records. I've got one for you, which is a duo from Canada called Tassiomancy. It's all very Kate Bushy. Are you sort of...
No, not until you told me about them.
Down with
I've
these ethereal types.
Don't know.
Should we have a little bit of the opening track from their upcoming LP? This is called Dead Can Dance and Neil Young. But the bed's been made.
Oh,
That's Tassio Mansi, who are a sister. They're twin sisters. They're from Canada. They're quite interesting types. What do we think about that? Did we miss Shakespeare's sister while they were away?
It's very Kate Bush, incredibly,
isn't it?
Kate Bush.
It's deeply Kate Bush. Yeah. I think a nice one for the autumn. Possibly.
Yeah, nice voices.
Yeah, good voices.
Very nice. You can understand the lyrics, unlike the Cocteau Twins. So yeah.
What is Tassio Mansi?
I don't know what
some kind of
Tassio Mansi. I don't know what it is. It feels like some
sounds illegal.
Sorcery. Yeah. Some sort of sorcery. Are we going to Google it while the program's
happening? Sure.
Okay. Karen's got her laptop.
I got
we can do that. Okay, that was The World in Music, or The Autumn in Music. Will Hodgkinson, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Indeed. God, I really want to see some more pictures of the Lemon Twigs, actually.
You here.
Really, it's Todd Rundgren, one of the ugliest men in show business, who pulled the most beautiful women.
Yeah.
That's what they're doing. They're channeling that wonderful, flared, long-haired, floppy.
Yeah.
I kind of dig that.
That's a glam. There's a good glam look going on there.
It's glam also, but it's Todd Rundgren. It's also got that kind of
very Todd Rundgren,
producer side.
Yeah, yeah. You
know. Divination by Tea Leaves.
Ah, okay. Divination by Tea Leaves.
Tassio.
That's very sort of. They're a very straight edge duo. There.
Well, you know, there's not much going on in Canada. You know, Tea Leaves. Right? I mean,
so I hear
small uptown thing in New York. Like, hey, let's dig into Dad's vinyl collection. Sure.
From the time.
This is what happens in small towns. People go.
Okay. Down a hole.
Exactly.
Okay, it's time for films now.
Oh,
Karen Krasanovich, your time is nigh.
I was hoping you were going to choose the handsome man to your left, but no, I guess not.
The Birth of a Nation is the first thing you've picked out.
Yes,
yes. Talk to this one.
Okay, well, I've chosen this one. It's a very uneven movie, and it's had a lot of attention since its two awards at Sundance.
Heavenly Father, we come to thank you for your word and your will.
You listen to him, and you might just make it into heaven.
Amen.
Black bodies swinging in the southern breeze.
Submit yourselves to your masters with all respect.
Okay, that was a taster from The Birth of a Nation. It's out this Friday in the United States. So, Karen, what do we think of this movie post 12 Years a Slave?
The reason I'm mentioning it is because it's spearheading one of the trends for later this year and upcoming years, is that we're getting some genuine diversity in the Hollywood films. Hollywood's in trouble. They're noticing that a lot of the stuff that used to work for them is no longer working. You'll see fewer superheroes, or at least better ones, coming up. Stars are losing their power. Documentaries are beginning to take more grip. The extremes of disaster films, like films that have lost a lot of money or made a lot of money, there's further and further apart. And
there's
also
disaster films and disastrous
films. Yes, exactly. Thinking Irwin Allen. Don't need a towering inferno to understand that China is part of the bigger market. But this one by Nate Parker is about the literate slave and preacher in antebellum South who went against the establishment for a few days, the slave rebellion. And it is, by all accounts, a very uneven film. I haven't actually seen it myself, so I don't want to say too much. But what's important about this is that this is a major film. It's controversial. It's getting people talking. But also, it doesn't seem to be as strange or exceptional as maybe it would have been maybe 5 years ago. Like, ooh, are we doing this? I mean, and this is on the back of a lot of previous films. We've got a lot of genuinely, it seems very normal now, diversity. Like, we've got Loving coming up, Sleight of Hand, Sunshine with You, The Fitz, all of these other things coming up. So that's really why I'm mentioning it.
But this is one that will obviously, this is going to launch into United States, which the rest of the world has suddenly gone, oh, wow. You know, 10 black kids die every day in most American cities. So this is launching to a knowing public for a change, perhaps.
Well, I mean, America's beginning to understand that it has some serious racial problems. I mean, serious racial problems. And I think that so many people watch films in so many different ways that this diversity really has to make a change. And that's one of the reasons why I think it's important that we recognize this film.
That was The Birth of a Nation. It's out this Friday in the United States. It's directed by Nate Parker. Next, Karen, you wanted to talk about Manchester by the Sea. We're going up north here, aren't we?
We're going to America, actually. It's not that Manchester. Manchester. It's a newer one.
Oh, no. I didn't mean that Manchester.
Oh.
I mean, it looked pretty chilly in the trailer. I thought we might be going up.
Why is it? It's
Martha's
chilly.
Vineyard or somewhere.
Chilly and it's hot.
Okay.
It's up sort of up Boston way. Let's put it that way. It's by director Kenneth Lonergan, who is
He's
Oscar
a great writer,
nominated.
Right?
Yeah. Mostly plays, I would have to say. Two-time Oscar-nommed. What's interesting about this, okay, it's more of an independent production, and the log line is an uncle's forced to take care of his teenage nephew. I don't want to give too much away.
Okay.
And it's a long film. I remember checking my watch thinking, man, I'm enjoying this, but when already?
Right.
It's only 2 hours.
Do you think
15.
They'll put that on the poster?
I've had stuff put on buses that I wish they hadn't put on with my name attached. But I actually saw it on Google Maps. No! On a bus. But what's really interesting about this, and I think this is another trend, where we're starting to get better dialogue, better stories, actors allowed to act, and a longer. I mean, there are many longers in this, so you almost feel like you're watching a stage play. But the performances are amazing and moving. And the whole thing is interesting, but it has an unusual shape that it doesn't really feel like a film. It needs to be re-edited in order to really become like more like a film. Nevertheless, Casey Affleck puts in an astonishing central performance of an amazing character and very, very real. And Michelle Williams as his ex-wife. She's tremendous here. And also they do not save all the best scenes for the beginning. There's some sucker punches at the end. We like, bring your hankies, because the less I say about this film, the better. Also, there's a tremendous performance by Lucas Hedges, who is in Grand Budapest Hotel, among others.
And this is the kid. This is the boy that needs looking after.
Wow. This is an actor to watch.
Okay, that's good stuff. Don't tell us too much about it.
Manchester
by the Sea.
I don't want to ruin it for
you. The film with the most boring logline in history. Karen Krasanovich rates.
Honestly, if you go and see it.
Someone goes down the pub. No, it wasn't there.
He does.
Oh, he does go down there.
But it's one of these films that I didn't know anything about. I was taken to go and see it. And wow.
Okay. Next. We're kind of looking at sort of the state of the world through the prism of seeds.
We are. And so
the untold story.
I know.
I've made it sound silly by saying it in that way. I apologize for that.
They were really struggling for a better title. It didn't come up with it. Quickly, we've got a deadline. Okay.
Yeah.
Let's call it
Growing
Seed.
Growing Pains?
Untold.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah, so it's Seed, the thing that's sprouting up the... No. Okay. Really, why I'm mentioning this is, again, it's another trend, is that documentaries used to be... Oh, you got to watch them because they're good for you. Or they're sort of iffy, or they're a bit rank or whatever. Or they're new, like Senna like broke the mold or whatever. And I think that the important thing about Seed is it represents the new importance of documentaries, where they're not only informational, they're informative, they're corrective. They change your mind about things. And they're entertaining. And they also, when you go to sleep, you worry about them. Right.
Okay.
So you're like, this is all about the 12,000-year-old food legacy.
This is the insomnia test.
This is going to keep you awake at night, that we will all starve if this food repository of seeds disappears. Now, it's made by two filmmakers. Taggart Siegel is, for 30 years, he's been a documentary maker, Emmy nominated. He's also made something, The Queen of the Sun. I love this. That's an alternative look at the bee crisis. So he's really focusing in on the food thing. Now, this is just an example of things that documentaries to watch to give you insomnia about the world. This is a new trend. But there are also many, many other really good ones coming up. For example, I'll just mention fleetingly because we're running out of time, is the Louis Theroux My Scientology movie.
Okay.
Which he goes to investigate Scientology.
Is this a theatrical release?
Yeah, okay. It is. And the Scientologists decide they're going to make a movie about him. They're so tricky.
Aren't they tricky?
Yeah, they're very, very tricky. But there are lots of important trends coming up this fall, but those are three of them.
I love the idea of both of your documentary choices at the end there. We're going to play a little clip just to make sure our listeners don't get off to sleep too well tonight, or they wake up at 3 a.m. fretting about the state of the seed bank.
Seeds? I worry.
Here's a little bit of a clip of Seed, the Untold Story.
Seed saving is all about sex. And humans are all obsessed with sex, even if it's rutabaga sex.
My sweetheart.
This is right up there with making love to your spouse.
Seeds are so crafty.
The diversity in our seed stocks is as endangered as a panda or a polar bear right now.
And that was a little bit of a clip of Seed, the Untold Story, one of two fantastic-sounding documentary choices by Karen Krasanovich, who also told us about Manchester by the Sea and Birth of a Nation. Thank you very much indeed, Karen.
Pleasure.
I think our listeners will be able to Be able to sleep well at night. Sorry, after that clip.
The sex part with the seeds, but you know.
Yeah.
Rutabaga sex. I love
Rutabaga
it.
Sex. It's a bit strange.
Cover your kids' ears.
Yeah. That voice is that of John Mitchinson. He's going to talk us through books. John, lots of great choices on your list here. We're just going to kick off with Nell Zink.
Ah, Nell Zink.
Yeah, she's an interesting... She's a kind of...
Yeah, third novel in 18 months, which is pretty astonishing. And one of the reasons for that is she claims that she writes a novel in 3 weeks. Last year was published in the UK for the first time, The Wall Creeper, and then Mislaid, both to fantastic reviews. And the new novel, Nicotine, is her longest. I mean, I really don't know how long it took her to write, but it has a kind of an energy to it.
Maybe 4 weeks.
And it's one of those novels. The reason I chose her is I just think if you're interested in what's possible in fiction now, she's just a natural storyteller. But her attitude to language is kind of reckless. I mean, the book starts in 1985 with a teenage girl who's collecting waste on a rubbish dump in Colombia. She meets a European, sees her doing it. They talk halting words of Spanish, and then they walk off together, and then you jump forward and they're married and they've got a daughter, and it turns out that the guy is a Jewish shamanist who's running a kind of a holistic healing center with sweat lodges, and that you first meet the character Penny smoking a cigarette as an 11-year-old in a sweat lodge, and then we jump forward again and she's a 23-year-old business studies graduate. And her father is dying. And the first chunk of the book is one of the most remarkable portraits I've ever read of the process of somebody dying and the grief that goes with it. It's quirky, it's full of dark humour, but it's also incredibly moving. The rest of the book is a sort of mad story, really. She inherits her father's house, which at that moment in time is being squatted in by a group of activists who are obsessed with all tobacco products, nicotine, cigarettes, chewing tobacco. And it's a kind of group of really cool modern hippies. And there's a whole network in the book of sort of alternative. There's the kind of hardcore feminist squats. So it's a sort of network of squats. And in the midst of all this madness, and then there's another one that are indigenous land rights, and they're very impressed with Penny because she's kind of half Kogi. So the whole... It's completely mad. The plotting in the book is so complicated. It would make, it's a 19th century novel in terms of it, all the intricacies. Does it work? Kind of just about gets away with it, largely because of her, Nell Zink's kind of just the verve and the quality of the...
There's a chutzpah to her writing.
Just amazing chutzpah to her. I mean, I just wanted one little sentence, which I think, you've got to be quite a brave writer to get away with this. This is when one of the characters has a major epiphany. And the sentence goes, "Sunlight fills her heart." And then open brackets, "inexplicable process defying prose description," close brackets. I mean, that's quite a brave...
Like a maths exam, always show your work.
Well, it's kind of... But there's a lot of that. There's a lot of experimentation in it. But the character of Penny and her kind of sinister brother, Matt, who they I can't even begin to explain how they're connected with different relationships. But it does have a sort of, I think, a joyous ending. I did just want to jemmy in, because I know you've talked about it before, but the book that everybody has got to read this autumn.
This is The Underground Railroad, Colson Whitehead. Yes, let's have a quickie on this.
Well, I am literally still shaking. I think it's probably the best book I've read in 20 years. It is America's 100 Years of Solitude. It is about... Yes, it's about slavery. The idea is the Underground Railway was a network of people who helped slaves escape. Colson Whitehead decides to make it a real underground railway. So there's a sort of magic realist premise. But the research in the book, he's gone back to sort of slave narratives, to the amazing archive, WPA had. And the stories, I mean, it is harrowing beyond endurance. There are several times I had to put the book down but the story at its heart, it's about Cora and Caesar, who are escaped slaves. They're being pursued by this guy Ridgway, who's a sort of monster. It's deeply important book about what it says about the fact of racism, which disfigures even more than ever, I think. I mean, at the moment with Black Lives Matter, if there's one book, it was an opera choice. It has the Obama seal of approval. It will probably win the Pulitzer. It deserves to win any prize it's entered for. It's an astonishing... It's his sixth novel, but I think it's at a different level. It will be the one book I'll press on everybody this autumn.
Well, thank you very much for talking us through The Underground Railroad, Colson Whitehead. It sounds like it's a must-read. It's nice also when other people around the table here, experts in their fields, are scribbling things down as well. Okay, we're going to go to one of your books now, John. It's Nicholas Lander's book about menus. Now, this, I've had a look through some of the gullies that you sent through earlier. Now, this is a handsome book. This is a beautiful thing.
This was a book where we had an idea. We thought, why has nobody done a book about menus? We spend our lives going into restaurants looking at menus. I love menus. I met Nick Lander, who is the FT restaurant reviewer, and he said, well, I've always said it that a menu is the world's favourite piece of paper. You know, it's that thing where you're sitting at a table and you look. So what we did then
and then
was,
the bill comes, the world's least favourite.
Yeah, well, true. But the expectation, the hope that a menu represents that. So what we thought, well, also, it's kind of, it's obviously, we thinking about our previous success with letters, we thought menus of note is a sort of idea. So on the menu, in a way, is a collection of over 100 fabulous menus from all over the world and from some of the brilliant ones from the 1940s. There's the amazing menu from Paris in the siege of Paris in 1870, where they were serving animals from the zoo, you know, sort of rat cassoulet and so right through to Noma, Reni Redzepi's kind of Scandinavian restaurant. There's the restaurants from the fact. There's a sort of a vicarious pleasure in being able to look at places that you may never afford to eat in. Massimo Bottura's Osteria Francescana, which is restaurant of the year at the moment. And interviews with the chefs about how they go about making their menus. The stuff, obviously, about how the menu developed. There's even stuff we've just got books. There's a section of just menus that just look fabulous. So the kind of visual appeal of them is huge. And there's one section which I really like, which is the thing that people never think about, which is, particularly in America, is the restaurant briefing. When the maitre d' sits down with the chef and the waiting staff and goes through each of the dishes, I'm always amazed by how extraordinary kind of detailed you get that pitch in American restaurants. Our fiddlehead ferns are grown in an organically sealed unit, and all that stuff. You've got Imbabo, which is the legendary Italian American restaurant run by Mario Batali, and there's a great scene where Nick sits in on the restaurant briefing. So it's an insider's guide, but it's also, if it's food porn you like, if you just like looking at extraordinary combinations, and there's restaurants, as I say, from all over the world.
It's called On the Menu. It's by Nicholas Lander, and that is coming out on November the 3rd, published by Unbound. Finally, we're going from food porn to porn. this is My Dad Wrote a Porno. Now, this is an interesting one, right? This is a podcast being turned into
this
a book.
Is very close to being my favourite podcast of all time. It's such a simple...
Steady on, John.
It's such a... I know.
I would have known I could have included this genre in my films.
Okay. Well, I included this because this is another idea now, how books are happening. And this is a book that's being made from a podcast, which, you know, even 5 years ago would have seemed like an insanity. The podcast has been riotously successful. Very simple premise. Jamie Morton, who is a very funny man, very funny writer, was amazed to discover that his father had written a book, and he offered him the book to read. And the book turns out to be a porn novel called Belinda Blinked. And he was so traumatized by it because it was kind of, he was reading it, it's so compelling because it's sort of so terrible. But at the same time, it's a bit like The Office, you know, it's a bit like Wernham Hogg. Indeed, that the premise of the book, Belinda Blinked, is that Belinda is a senior sales rep for Steele's Pots and Pans, a kind of a pots and pan business. And she uses sex basically to earn her bonus. And she has, I mean, implausibly large amount of sex in the working day, but lands lots of deals. She's opening up the North American market. She's got girls in the office who are also similarly kind of equipped. I mean, it's ridiculously mad, unreconstructed. It's sort of like a down-market Jilly Cooper, but much sexier. And the thing is, the writing about sex is so terrible. You know, he grabbed her clitoris, that kind of thing. Breasts hanging like pomegranates. Her nipples were like the three-inch rivets they used on the Titanic, you know, all the way through. But there is... What they do in the podcast is they take it apart. They just take the book apart and make... And they record it. It's Alice Levine and another friend of Jamie Morton's as well. The three of them are very funny, and they talk about... You know, they read passages out. They've all had a meal. Jamie's usually had a few glasses of wine, and it's hilariously funny. The annotations as funny almost as the prose. So it's a kind of it's a very weird modern idea for a book. But what they're doing, what Quercus, the publisher, is doing, which I think is very clever, is they're doing the whole text of Belinda Blinked but with all the annotations and with also added extras like a list of Belinda's sales tips and, you know, a kind of academic attempt at looking at the themes and motifs in the book, illustrations for some of the sexual manoeuvres, the clitoris grabbing, for example, which comes up several times. It's hugely good fun. I'm sure the podcast has been downloaded 14 million times. Yep. I'm sure the book will do really, really well. There's a fondness. I mean, he's called... His dad's nom de plume is Rocky Flintstone. But there's something about Rocky's kind of indefatigable. And Jamie says at one point, he says, if it wasn't for me and my two sisters, I would honestly believe my father had never had sex. It's so
badly realised.
Yeah, but in a way, it's the badness of the realisation. So I haven't seen the book, but I'm joyously looking forward to it.
Sounds like a Christmas classic. This reminds me of Thrill Mama from the Train. Where one of these, like, you know, women I'd like to pork. It's a coffee table book.
Well, that's fantastic. I'm amazed we managed to get through a discussion about a book called My Dad Wrote a Porno About a Woman Who Works in the Pots and Pans Industry Without a Single Joke About Copper Bottoms. I'm really pleased about that. That is a good Christmas list.
Yes,
John, thank you very much for talking us through yours. And indeed, also to Will Hodgkinson and Karen Krasanovich, thank you very much for talking us through the rest of the year in film and in music. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. For the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.